Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on September 3, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group telephone conference call. On today's call, we'll be discussing the recent announcement by U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder that the Justice Department will no longer pursue mandatory minimum sentences for what he described as certain low-level nonviolent drug offenders. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion on our call today are those of our experts. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're going to hear from two experts in the field. Each is going to make opening remarks up to 10 to 12 minutes, after which we're going to have some moderated discussion and then questions from the audience, so do be ready with your questions. We're going to hear first from Professor William G. Otis. He is an adjunct professor of law at the Georgetown University Law Center and has worked in the U.S. Department of Justice as an assistant U.S. attorney in the past. He'll be followed by Professor Douglas A. Berman, the Robert J. Watkins Procter & Gamble Professor of Law at Moritz College of Law at The Ohio State University. He's also helps work on the Federal Sentencing Reporter, a publication comes out periodically. And I wanted to alert you to the fact that there'll be some commentary on these same issues in the December issue of that publication. That, again, is the Federal Sentencing Reporter. Probably most of you are already familiar with it. As I mentioned, we'll start with opening remarks. Professor Otis, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean, and I want to thank Doug for agreeing to participate in this call about a very important and timely subject, mandatory minimum sentencing. I want to start with a case that Doug posted about on his excellent blog last week. It was about a 49-year-old school teacher who was recently convicted of raping a 14-year-old student who later committed suicide. The teacher was sentenced last week. The judge gave him a prison term, all but 30 days of which was suspended. In imposing what was effectively a 30-day sentence for raping a ninth grader, the judge remarked, among other things, that the girl, quote, seemed older than her chronological age, end quote, and was, quote, as much in control of the situation, end quote, as the teacher. And with that, you've just heard much of what you need to hear about why mandatory minimum sentencing is indispensable to justice. We can have worthwhile debates about which crimes warrant mandatories and how high or low the minimum should be, but I don't think we can sensibly debate the framers' wisdom that the power of a government is best exercised when it is distributed among the branches, not concentrated in a single branch, much less a single person, whether or not he is wearing a robe. It's wise to give a good deal of discretion to judges, and our system does so. It's foolish and, as the case I described shows, sometimes scandalous to give them absolutely all of it. We need checks and balances. We need them today, just as we did when the Constitution was written, allowing the legislature to direct that there are some crimes so serious that your judge will be required to impose a rock-bottom sentence is not a denial of sympathy. It's an insurance policy against injustice. The Attorney General's remarks 3 weeks ago evinced no recognition of any of this. They consisted in equal measures of forgetting the past and being complacent about what we've achieved in the present. The Attorney General wants to turn back the clock on a sentencing system we know works to keep us safer than we have been in 50 years, in favor of one we know fails. At the same time, he wants to discard the last pillar of law-driven sentencing to embrace a luck-of-the-draw system that pretends sentencing is fairer if it's more idiosyncratic. The windfall beneficiaries of the Attorney General's largesse are not going to be the huge majority of Americans who live normal, peaceable lives. They're going to be the small fraction of 1% who, by their criminal choices, earn their spot in federal prison. Now, I need to give some history here. Two generations ago in the 60s and 70s, our country had the sentencing system Mr. Holder wants to resuscitate. We convinced ourselves that rehabilitation works and that we could almost always trust judges to get it right at sentencing with no binding input from Congress. For our trouble, we got a national crime wave. Crime was twice what it is now. By By the 80s, Congress had wised up and embraced determinate sentencing. That meant binding sentencing guidelines and, for a few serious offenses, mandatory minimums below which the judge can't go. To my way of thinking, that was an enormous achievement. For the first time, our country systematically introduced the rule of law to replace largely unfettered judicial discretion. For those in the audience who are not attorneys, the phrase judicial discretion is lawyer talk that sounds high-minded, but actually means the judge can do whatever he wants. We got something important for the reforms that made sentencing conform to law. From the 90s to the present day, we have enjoyed a 50% reduction in crime to levels not seen since the baby boomers were in high school. This massive increase in our ability to live in peace and safety has been a moral and an economic boom. According to Bureau of Justice statistics, there are now more than 4 million fewer serious crimes in America than there were a generation ago. Over the last several years, then, literally millions of ordinary Americans did not become crime victims and did not have to fork out to pay hospital bills or replace stolen savings. These savings to individual citizens were papered over by the Attorney General, who told us that the government will spend less by shrinking the prison population. A cynic might wonder about the Justice Department's sudden and selective concern for frugality coming, as it does, from an administration that has already borrowed $6 trillion to pay for things it actually cares about. But even the credulous can't help noticing that the Attorney General's claims about cost reduction ignore the millions of dollars, not to mention the human suffering, that successfully controlling crime through incarceration has already saved private citizens. Mandatory sentencing laws and increased imprisonment did not alone produce these benefits. Let's be clear about that. There were other things involved, hiring more police, much more effective private security measures. But mandatory minimums and the increased imprisonment they helped to produce did contribute significantly. The late James Q. Wilson agreed with other scholars who found that increased imprisonment in the 90s accounted for a quarter or more of the decrease in crime. Mr. Holder's allies have mostly not disputed that. Instead, they say that continuing to incarcerate produces diminishing marginal returns, and that's true. It's true because it's a truism. Diminishing marginal returns to the dollar is virtually always a feature of domestic or any other spending, and returns are still returns. Now Mr. Holder wants to jeopardize our progress by gutting mandatory minimum sentencing in federal court. He's directed that, for the most part, federal prosecutors must airbrush indictments so that they no longer detail the true extent of the defendant's criminal behavior. Detail that, if alleged and proved, would require the court to impose at least a minimum sentence. I think the Attorney General's program is misconceived. First, he says that he would limit his plan to nonviolent offenses. He apparently wants us to think that nonviolent means non-harmful, and that's clever, but it's not true. Nonviolent offenses can be extremely harmful, if not fatal. A heroin addict sliding the needle in his arm is nonviolent, but he can be dead by nightfall. Trafficking PCP or methamphetamine to a high school kid is nonviolent, but has started him down the path to ruin. The degenerate who, with the promise of a pretty dress, entices an 8-year-old to pose for pornographic pictures has done no violence, but he has defiled a little girl. Mr. Holder, to the contrary, Congress has every right and reason to demand that defendants like that receive at least a rock-bottom sentence that can't be watered down by an overly sympathetic or naive judge. It is one thing, and wise, to give judges substantial discretion. It's another to give them all of it. Because judges vary widely in temperament, ideology, and experience, letting individual judges decide without legislative constraint what the sentence will be is sure to lead to irrational disparity. Without congressionally imposed floors, we'll go back to the luck of the draw. Some judges will stick with mandatory sentences and some won't. Nearly identical defendants with similar records will get widely varying treatment based solely on whose courtroom they're assigned to. To those who say that we should end mandatory minimums and, quote, let judges be judges, as is often said, we need ask only one question. Would they also support an end to mandatory maximums? That is, if they wish to allow a judge full leeway in the case of a particularly sympathetic defendant, to give as low a sentence as the judge thinks is appropriate? Is there any principled reason for not allowing the same judge, for a particularly rapacious defendant, to give as high a sentence as he thinks appropriate? I can't think of any, but so far as I have heard from Mr. Holder or his allies, the plan to let judges be judges runs in only one direction. Finally, existing law already provides at least three escape hatches for deserving defendants facing a mandatory minimum. Often they can plea bargain their way to a lesser charge. Such bargaining is overwhelmingly the way federal cases are resolved at present. Even if convicted under a mandatory minimum charge, however, the judge on his own can sidestep the sentence if a defendant has a minor criminal history, is not engaged in violence, was not a big-time player, and makes a clean breast of his crimes. This safety valve, as it's known, has been in the law for almost 20 years. Separately, under existing law, called Section 3553E, a defendant can avoid a mandatory minimum by helping prosecutors bring his cohorts to justice. Forgetfulness about our past blunders and complacency about the crime reduction we've achieved are not the way to go. We tried the Attorney General's reforms before. They erode the rule of law, overestimate judicial discipline, and they don't work. Law-guided sentencing does, and that's what we should keep. Okay, Doug, over to you.
Well, thank you, Bill, and thanks to everyone on the call and for this forum to discuss matters. I think Bill has presented, as well as can be presented, the most fulsome case for mandatory minimum sentencing in the current status quo, though I think he readily elides certain details and eagerly combines other concepts in order to make the case as conceptually forceful as possible while ignoring some important realities. I won't try to respond point by point to what Bill has to say, but I will encourage a different framework and way to look at what the Attorney General, in my view, is doing. And my apologies in advance if this seems a little ivory tower out of the box, but such is the nature of hearing from somebody well within that ivory tower. And what I encourage everybody to think about, what frames my vision of what the Attorney General is here trying to do, is based on a thought experiment that I think isn't perfectly replicative of what we have in the federal system now, but actually somewhat disconcertingly is maybe more akin to what we have than we might want to imagine. Here's the thought experiment. Imagine if Congress were to say, as I think they would be constitutionally permitted to do, though we might debate that issue, that we're going to pick one random busy intersection in the nation, and we're going to mandate a 5-year prison sentence for the first 1,000 people who, captured by a red light camera, are caught violating the traffic safety laws. And so that's going to be our mandatory minimum sentence. It's going to be based on the belief that a 5-year prison term will not only deter people from running through that red light, but will usefully incapacitate that group from future lawbreaking of all sorts. Statistics show, and this is in some sense what Bill is pointing to, that we could expect to get some, perhaps some considerable crime control benefits from a mandatory decision to lock up in federal prison for 5 years the first 1,000 red light runners from that intersection. And there's actually two ways to unpack those statistics and two ways that I think are worth focusing on. First, statistically speaking, 1,000 folks, if it's just 1% who are likely to go on and commit a violent or serious crime in the next 5 years, that's 10 violent or serious crimes avoided from locking up, at least avoided in the outside, those 1,000 folks, 10 of whom are going to go commit that crime. In addition, and not to be overlooked to some degree, statistics also suggest that maybe 10 or more of those folks are likely to be the victims a violent or serious crime, and the fact that they're locked up in a penitentiary will likely keep them safe from being subject to crime on the outside. Obviously, all these folks might be subject to crime on the inside, but we have a tendency, and Bill's statistics certainly reflect a tendency, to diminish the significance of those crimes relative to crimes to the general public. putting aside all sorts of other kinds of concerns, the question isn't, would we get some crime control benefits from locking up those 1,000 folks? Simple math suggests we will. The question ultimately is at what cost? We could focus on, and in fact, most lawmakers, both at the federal level and at the state level, are finally starting to focus on just the economic costs that would attend to locking up those 1,000 red light runners for 5 years mandatorily. Roughly speaking, and this is a low estimate, it's $20,000 a year in just direct economic costs for locking somebody up in federal prison. It's actually more than that, but let's use that number. 5 years gets you to about $100,000 per person for those 1,000 red light runners. That means it's going to cost us $100 million. Again, you might say, what price should we put on justice? Or I think I heard Bill saying, for an administration that's eager to spend lots and lots of money on their preferred programs, why not be willing to spend $100 million in federal taxpayer funds to prevent 20 serious crimes and maybe more? And so if we think justice in this setting, or crime control more accurately, should not be subject to economic cost and benefit analysis, we could say that that's worth it. Although, of course, the first response would be, could we get a better, what's the opportunity cost? Could we get a better reduction in crime control if we use that $100,000 more effectively? I think ultimately as important, if not more important than the pure economic calculations, would be the cost in human terms, not just obviously for the 10 lawbreakers who would go on to commit additional crimes being locked up for 5 years, and whether we think that's a just way to prevent them from those potential crimes, but obviously for the 990 other individuals I've mentioned whose lives have been disrupted in order to try to lower crime statistically. In addition, and again, this is where the refinements start to come in, though we might have some significant crime control benefits for the 5 years when those 1,000 folks are locked up, there's good reason to believe, especially given evidence-based research, that time in prison is actually criminogenic, that for those who may be less likely to commit crimes, all things considered, if they their encounter with the criminal justice system doesn't involve immediate incarceration, we may get more crime after the 5 years from locking these 1,000 people up, not just the ones who would go commit a crime had they not been locked up during that five-year period, but others who would not be crime-oriented, but for the disruption in their lives and the other consequences of being confined. Not to mention as well, and this is another refinement here as well, removing those persons from potentially stable community environments may themselves create criminogenic forces, not just for them personally, but for family members and others. And I suspect, though I won't say for sure, among the reasons we don't hear a proposal like this bandied about in Congress, despite eagerness to be tough on crime, and despite the fact that Bill might say running a red light shouldn't be categorized as a nonviolent, non-harmful offense, because we all know that doing so can lead to car accidents and many deaths on our nation's highways. But rather, we recognize that more refinement in the way in which we use the expensive and not just economically expensive, but costly in human terms, punishment of incarceration is a more sensible way to go about achieving crime control benefits. Now, we might imagine a refinement. Maybe this would be Bill's proposed refinement. Well, don't incarcerate the first 1,000 people who run that red light. Let a prosecutor who presumably has a very keen sense of who may or may not be more worthy in a particular case of that five-year prison sentence, maybe the one who just sped through the light rather than tried to hit the brakes but still didn't quite make it, maybe the one the prosecutor would figure out was drinking a little bit too much, or maybe the prosecutor didn't like the kind of car. Or who knows what factors would be involved in a prosecutorial choice about how to screen through those 1,000 red light runners and decide in the prosecutor's view, and I emphasize here the prosecutor, because that's what mandatory minimums, as they function in our federal system, really in any system, does. They are a tool by which prosecutors get to screen among those potentially guilty of a particular crime who prosecutors think, and with no check and balance from a judge, no check and balance from transparency or appellate review that necessarily is part of any judicial decision making, or at least should be in a well-functioning system, and certainly is in our current federal system, a system that lets prosecutors screen when and whether they think the crime control benefits for locking up a particular red light runner for 5 years or maybe 10 years or 15 years. And I want to be the first to say, I sincerely hope when a prosecutor is given that discretion, they make some good choices, that only valid crime control considerations come to the fore, that it's not the nature of the car or other potentially less relevant or irrelevant factors that lead a prosecutor to decide, yes, I think we'll get more crime control benefits from locking this person up for 5 years, but this other one who ran the red light, you know what, it's good enough to give them a fine or otherwise encourage some lesser disposition. I hope prosecutors, when they, in the federal system, make those screening choices, now we're no longer talking about running red lights, but we are talking, in fact, about dealing in relatively small quantities of crack cocaine, dealing in relatively small quantities of methamphetamine, dealing in rather small quantities of a variety of other relatively severe drug offenses that trigger, at the minimum, this 5-year mandatory minimum. Or if we turn to sex crimes, which Bill focused on as well, we're not dealing in the federal system with prosecutors using their discretion to decide between rape offenses. Those are almost exclusively handled at the state system. What we're actually dealing with is a fellow who in his basement has downloaded a picture and done no more than downloaded a picture of child pornography, and it's completely in the prosecutor's discretion under current federal law to decide whether to charge that individual with a mere possession offense, which carries no mandatory minimum, or a receipt offense, which carries a 5-year mandatory minimum. And there is no principled basis either in law or even in current instructions from the Attorney General, in part because his memo and new policy doesn't speak to this, in how a prosecutor should decide whether or not a 5-year mandatory minimum is more appropriate under those circumstances than allowing, as Bill would put it, judges to be judges and luck of the draw sentencing. What we get now in the current system, given the way in which mandatory minimums are structured in the federal scheme, are prosecutors without any real law, without any real guidance, and certainly without any transparency or appellate review, the ability to pick and choose who they think must serve 5, 10, in some cases 20, or life incarceration terms, because they've made the judgment that they think that the crime control benefits are worth the cost to this individual, cost to society, cost to the community at large. And again, I hope they're making those judgments well. What I think the Attorney General's speech is ultimately doing, and I'll leave it at this, is saying, I'm not entirely convinced we're making those judgments effectively across the board, and I'm going to issue some new guidelines that call for us to make those judgments, first, a little bit more transparently, and second, with more of an attentiveness to the reality that though we may be getting some crime control benefits, the costs are awfully high, and particularly at a time when crime is down. And we can and should recognize that there are opportunity costs from mass incarceration, even though there may be crime control benefits. It's time for a recalibration, not to go back to a failed past, but rather to readjust our commitment to the rule of law in a way that ensures that prosecutors, all of whom I know are as committed to doing the right thing as Bill was when he was in that role, that prosecutors understand that the benefits of crime control that they may too readily see need to be balanced against the significant costs, both economic and human, that come from using long terms of incarceration in an effort to control crime. And with
Thank
that,
you,
I think we're done.
Thank you very much. Thank you both. I do want to go back to Bill Otis, Professor Otis, for his response. But first, let me start the process of opening the floor to questions. We'll all hear in a moment an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for either of our experts, you can indicate that by pushing the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So hold on for that announcement. So once again, if you have a question for either of our experts, you'll need to indicate that by pushing the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We'll get to your questions momentarily. Before I go back to Bill Otis, let me announce that tomorrow, Wednesday, we at 3 p.m. will be hosting a Teleforum conference call with FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai. He'll be talking about hot topics at the FCC, perhaps including the news breaking today, the Verizon-Vodafone agreement and the purchase of Nokia by Microsoft. Then on Friday, we're going to take a close look at the regulatory regime under the National Ambient Air Quality Standards in another Teleforum conference call. So check in with the Federal Society website for further details. But with that, Professor Otis, we've heard quite a bit in response to your opening remarks from Professor Berman. Do you want to take a couple minutes and offer a rejoinder?
I would. Thanks very much, Dean. I think Doug's discussion illustrates why it's such a pleasure to speak with him about this and other subjects, because he is indeed a balanced and nuanced thinker. I do not agree with some of the points he made, and just let me say briefly a word about them. Doug has talked a lot about prosecutorial discretion and how the prosecutor selects the charge. That, of course, is something that the framers wrote into the Constitution. It's not by virtue of prosecutorial arrogance, either Eric Holder's or any other attorney generals, that prosecutors select the charges. That is a core executive branch function. Another thing I would mention about this is that Eric Holder's proposal does nothing to cabin prosecutorial discretion. It changes some of the standards that prosecutors use, but it doesn't make the decision of what charge to bring or how to write the indictment any more subject to outside scrutiny than they were before. In addition to that, the primary bill in Congress that is singing the same tune as Mr. Holder, that being the Leahy-Rand Paul bill, also does nothing to cabin prosecutorial discretion or to make it more open. If we want to do that, I'm all in favor of it. I have, in other contexts, spoken up for considerably more examination of some of Mr. Holder's decisions. So that's a good thing. The problem is that neither his proposal nor congressional proposals will do any of that. The second thing I would say is that if Doug were correct that imprisoning people is carcinogenic, that is, if imprisoning people tended to breed crime, then what we would expect is that as we have incarcerated many more people, as we have over the last 20 years, we'd get a whole lot more crime. Instead, our experience has been the opposite. As we've incarcerated many more people, we have gotten vastly less crime. We've gotten 50% less crime. The third point I would make is that I think that Doug underplayed to an extent the enormous benefits that, including the enormous economic benefits that we have reaped from the 50% reduction in crime. Of course, any sensible person does want to engage in a cost-benefit analysis, as Doug pointed out. But there are two components in that that I think deserve special emphasis. One is that the money that is now not being spent by people who have not become crime victims also counts in the cost-benefit analysis. The second is that if we have less incarceration or we release prisoners early, as was done by the partial retroactive effect given the Fair Sentencing Act and the crack context, what's going to happen is not, as the Attorney General said in his speech to the ABA, or it's not going to be uniformly the case, as he said, that they're going to rejoin their families and be pillars of the community and get productive jobs. That's not actually what happens with people who are convicted of federal felonies. What happens is the recidivism rate is about two-thirds, and even for those who do not recidivate, Many of them will wind up not being producers of the economy. They'll wind up continuing to take taxpayer subsidies in the form of welfare payments, subsidized housing, and medical care. So while I'm all for a cost-benefit analysis, I don't think it actually produces the same result that Doug thinks it does.
Very good. I'm going to give Professor Berman another shot here, but let me announce again, our phone lines are open. We don't have any questions pending. If you have a question for either of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And Professor Berman, what I'm interested in two things in particular, but you can address whatever you'd like. Are you in favor, what's your position on mandatory maximums, something Professor Otis mentioned in his opening remarks? And also, what about the cost-benefit analysis and the costs to the victims on that side of the ledger?
Very good. And two things I'll say about mandatory is defined however one wants to. I actually share very much so Bill's perspective that a set of checks and balances in writing a script for sentencing is extraordinarily important, and I think absolutely fundamental to that is a requirement, or put it differently, I would say an expectation, and then maybe I'd even imagine a world in which it would be a requirement, that Congress provide an articulation of what they think should be, as Bill put it, the rock-bottom floor and the rock-bottom ceiling, or rock-top ceiling, I suppose it would be, for the seriousness of any particular offense. I think it is very important, and I think part of the bad old days that Bill mentioned that concerns him is a world in which when we were really committed to a rehabilitative vision of punishment and sentencing, Congress and state legislatures completely deferred on articulating a societal perspective through democratically elected representatives of what are more or less serious crimes. And I think providing for minimums and maximums are an essential part of that. And so it's important to keep in mind, and I encourage Congress to keep in mind that kind of articulation. And to me, what turns this from an important theoretical point into a challenging federal concrete point is the failure of Congress to do that, either with minimums or with maximums across a range of what we, I think, generally believe are the most serious and most important federal interest type crimes. When we're talking about broad white collar offenses of the kind that always get attention and that there's very little suggestion that the states can handle broad white collar offenses that cross many states and affect economic markets profoundly. It is the case right now that none of those offenses have a mandatory minimum, and in fact, many of them right now have a relatively low maximum. Very interesting, among other things, just to as a bit of historical reality, the reason Bernie Madoff got a quote-unquote maximum sentence of 150 years rather than life was because he pled guilty to a series of offenses that had 10-year mandatory maximum sentences, notwithstanding that I think we would all readily assert that his kind of economic offense was among the more egregious in American history. In sharp contrast, it remains the case that somebody involved in dealing only 280 grams, this is after the recent reforms of crack sentencing, but somebody involved in a street-level deal involving only 280 grams of crack cocaine is subject to a 10-year mandatory minimum. So we have a world in which Congress has articulated, in my view, not reflective of societal perspectives, that the kinds of crimes that Bernie Madoff committed should be subject to a 10-year maximum. Now, he got more because he committed multiple crimes. Nevertheless, again, the failure of Congress to use minimums and maximums effectively across the penal code. And this actually gets to a different historical story. The entire move to modern sentencing reform that Bill praises and I likewise think was a significant advancement in criminal jurisprudence was driven by a broader desire to reform the federal criminal code, which is a bloody mess in lots of particulars and is worthy of time and attention by our nation's representatives. But understandably, we might say, there are other things that they have their focus on, not just in the short term, but for quite some time, in part because judges and prosecutors, historically sharing this power, have been relatively effective, even without mandatory minimums, at screening so that we get, to turn to the cost-benefit analysis, ideally maximum benefits at relatively minimal costs from our current federal criminal justice system. And what I see the Attorney General saying, and what I see these bills in Congress suggesting, and what I think is part and parcel of a broader appreciation for many of the factors that Bill is emphasizing, but with significantly more refinement than I think Bill sometimes articulates, is that we have, in fact, gotten significant benefits from mass incarceration, from a federal prison population, which is now just at the federal level as large today as was the entire national prison population 40 years ago. We've gotten significant crime control benefits from it, not to mention beyond the cost-benefit analysis in crass crime control terms, but also in terms of achieving justice and portraying society the way we might more broadly hope our justice system portrays it, but at a significant cost. And again, I don't want to emphasize, though I think it's worthwhile emphasizing, merely the economic costs of mass incarceration, which, again, at the state level, the bills have come due so dramatically that we've seen states across the nation, particularly red states, as Attorney General Holder emphasized, reducing their economic footprint for incarceration and not yet enduring any detriment in crime control. If anything, there's evidence to suggest getting significantly more bang for their buck by trying alternatives to incarceration. But beyond the economic costs, there's also the costs as defined, as challenging it might be, to a nation that, as Abraham Lincoln put it, was conceived in liberty. To me, the other piece of incarceration that is most disturbing is a kind of a concession to human inability to encourage fellow humans to avoid harming and otherwise creating disorder by any means other than locking them up and not quite throwing away the key, but keeping them confined for extended periods of time. I'd like to believe, in fact, there's good reason and good evidence to suggest, we should all believe that there are, at least for some of those currently in federal prison, other means to encourage better behavior and other means to vindicate our commitment to liberty and limited government, other than just locking up lots of people who, again, maybe statistically are likely to threaten some harm. But that's true for all of us at some level. And so as we do that cost-benefit analysis, again, which I think ultimately just in pure economic terms would call for a reduction in our imprisonment footprint, but that we also think about our broader societal values and our commitment to liberty and limiting government, which as a nation with only 5% of the population and 25% of those incarcerated, unless we have an incredible chutzpah about our ability to use incarceration as no other nation does, or as Jim Webb would say, unless we think we're a uniquely unruly and law-breaking population, there's got to be reasons for us to at least question, and I think that's all the Attorney General is doing, question whether the path that we've embraced for the last 40 years that emphasizes the benefits and minimizes the costs of mass incarceration should be a pattern that we continue on, or if the federal system ought to do what the states have done across the board, which is try to find refinements that get us most of those benefits at significantly fewer costs, both economic and social.
Once again, to our audience, our lines are open. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We don't have any questions pending at this point. Let me ask a question of each of you, though, hopefully steer things towards a legal discussion. You might have quick answers to this. There's been a lot of discussion on policy. For Professor Otis, is Attorney General Eric Holder, you know, within his legal rights here within his legal authority to do what he suggested he's going to do, that is to not enforce some of these laws. And for Professor Berman, is this the right way legally to go around, to go about changing, essentially changing mandatory minimums? Don't we have a sentencing commission? Isn't there a process for changing mandatory minimums rather than just simply waiving them or deciding not to enforce them?
Maybe I'll go first on that with the question that you directed to me, Dean, whether the Attorney General is within his rights in simply declining in a fairly significant sense to enforce the law. In other words, to write indictments in a way that would require judges, if the indictment is proved, the defendant is convicted, would require the judge to impose a mandatory minimum sentence. I might get in trouble with some of my conservative friends here, but I think he is acting, if not wisely, at least properly, under the written text of the Constitution. The Attorney General is a politically appointed officer, and he is entitled to execute the law with the priorities of his boss, the president. Priorities are going to change, and they do change from administration to administration. Under the present administration, there may be more emphasis on prosecuting white-collar crimes, environmental crimes. Under different administrations, there would be more emphasis on prosecuting drug crimes, child pornography. I think that each attorney general is entitled, by the political nature of his office, to exercise his discretion as to how to execute the law according to his own beliefs. That's why, you know, that's why we have the kind of accountability that the Constitution provides, which is accountability at the ballot box, not from judges. The Attorney General, this Attorney General and others, should be free to pursue their own prerogatives. And if people don't like that, the way to change it is to vote in an administration that appoints an attorney general, not take it up in court.
And I share Bill's perspective there, and I want to sort of add to that by praising Attorney General Holder for making a big splash as he rolled out this new policy, because I think, as I think Bill and I suggested before, greater transparency and greater accountability, whether that be political accountability or through other means, maybe media accountability and the like, is, I think, essential to the well-functioning aspects of the executive branch from the checks and balances perspective. And there's long been reason to be concerned, and we only need to read the headlines with some other topics du jour abounding, that different choices get made by executive branch officials without the kind of public discourse, without the public disclosure. Again, we might think that there are crime control reasons or others that certain programs need to be kept secret, and I don't want to engage in that debate, but particularly with respect to not only the lawful authority of what the Attorney General is doing here, but the virtue of encouraging a public debate over these topics as he announces these new policies. And I think indisputably, both the Attorney General and I suspect his boss would encourage Congress to move forward on a variety of these fronts as well. And the Attorney General mentioned in his speech support for a number of bills that have been proposed by, ironically, one might say, the extremes of both parties. Folks on the far left and the far right have tended to come together to encourage a reining in of a variety of federal sentences what they perceive to be federal criminal justice overreaches. And my sense is, though there may be some debate both within the Obama administration and the way in which they'd interact with Congress, this isn't an effort to kind of do it and run around. This, I don't believe, is an assertion, like we've heard with President Obama in some other settings, well, Congress won't do what I want, so therefore I'm going to do everything I possibly can to get where I want to go with Congress stuck. This seems to be an area. Interestingly, a commentator recently asserted that federal sentencing reform was perhaps unstoppable now. I wouldn't quite go that far. I think momentum kind of ebbs and flows on these frontiers based on a variety of different factors. But my sense is, in thinking about the Attorney General's move here, in addition to my view that it is, as Bill suggested, you know, legally within his lawful authority to make these choices, the way in which he rolled it out, the way in which he made a public statement and disclosed with some specificity what his vision here is, both should be a mechanism to help prod Congress to make some policy choices here and enable Congress, for example, if there is strong sentiment against what the Attorney General is proposing, there are a variety of mechanisms in which Congress can signal, both directly and indirectly, its desire to take a different kind of approach. The signals coming out of Congress these days, it seems, in fact, I think one of the reasons we got the Attorney General's speech is because the signals coming out of Congress these days, it seems, is to go along the road of reforming mandatory minimums, of at least modifying the approaches that have been embraced historically, again, by both the left and the right. We've saw more mandatory minimums enacted during the Clinton years than in any other period in presidential history, with both a Democratic and Republican Congress in charge at various times. And that's largely because in the 90s we saw increases in crime rates that may have quite justifiably led us to say the benefits of crime control are worth whatever costs of increasing incarceration. But we're not at that time anymore, and I think that both explains why we're seeing this slow but steady sea change away from mass incarceration, but also why I think it's sensible that the Attorney General is being an important voice in that broader discourse.
Let's go to our audience. Go ahead, Bill.
I probably want to add one or two things to clarify what I said before. If, for example, the Attorney General decides tomorrow and makes an announcement that he thinks that he's become a libertarian and he thinks all drugs should be decriminalized, that it's up to an individual to decide for himself what drugs are too dangerous, and therefore he's not going to bring, and he's going to direct federal prosecutors from now on not to bring any write any indictments for federal drug offenses. Now, that is within his rights. It would be a radical thing to do, but it's within his rights, but it would be an extremely unwise thing to do, and it would be in very considerable tension with the oath that all officers of the executive branch take to see that the law is faithfully executed. So I want to say that to clarify the answer I gave you previously about my view that although it's the same answer, I do continue to believe that the Attorney General is constitutionally acting within his authority to do that. The second thing I want to say is that if you look at specifically what the Attorney General told federal prosecutors to do, this illustrates my point that while he's acting within his constitutional authority, what he's actually doing is evading Congress. And it would be the more transparent and I think the more constitutionally friendly thing to do to go to Congress with this. What the Attorney General said specifically in his directions to federal prosecutors is that from now on, we're not going to write indictments that are going to require a mandatory minimum if the defendant has up to 3 criminal history points. In the currently existing safety valve in the statute, which is called 3553F, the safety valve that I mentioned in my opening remarks is available, but only if the defendant has a very minor criminal history, one criminal history point. So what the Attorney General, in effect, is doing is amending the current statutory safety valve by allowing no mandatory minimum when there is a greater degree of prior criminality than exists under present law. The other change that he is in effect amending the now statutorily existing safety valve, is he saying that the defendant need not make a clean breast of everything he's been up to and everything his cohorts have been up to. Under the present safety valve, which I might add was introduced in Congress and sponsored by then-Senator Joe Biden back in 1994 and Orrin Hatch, the defendant is required, in order to escape a mandatory minimum, he is required to make a clean breast of things. So what the Attorney General has done, in effect, is adopt two amendments to a congressionally approved statute. Again, it is within his constitutional authority to change priorities that federal prosecutors are going to have. But it's not the way to go. If he wants these changes, by far the better thing to do, the more transparent thing to do, and the thing that's more in keeping with public accountability, is to ask Congress to change the safety valve, not for him effectively just to do it on his own.
Let me chime in to say I think Bill's analysis of this is very astute and very appropriate, though I would encourage a slightly broader frame, which is that safety valve provision was put in place, as he mentioned earlier, about two decades ago. And from all reports, it's been extraordinarily successful, both in terms of facilitating the kind of disclosures and the kind of transparency, both in who's going to be able to escape the application of mandatory minimums without relying on the plea bargaining process or persons to otherwise cooperate about other criminal offending in order to get out from under an otherwise applicable mandatory minimums, and what a number of federal judges have been asserting for decades, is there can be, there often are, a number of offenders who may have slightly more criminal history or whom the prosecutor, in his or her discretion, may claim is not being completely truthful, but the defendant, him or herself, asserts that they're being completely truthful about their criminal background, and that those persons haven't been eligible under this statutory safety valve. And I share Bill's sense, and I read the Attorney General's speech as saying, these provisions to expand the safety valve are things I'd like to see in a legislative reform. However, until that time, in part because I have an obligation to allocate resources effectively and to facilitate a well-functioning federal criminal justice system, I think I should instruct my line prosecutors to, for the time being, adjust their approach to indicting these kinds of cases, which critically, and again I want to emphasize this point, doesn't guarantee anybody a lower sentence. All it does is now potentially untie the judge's hands in the application of a 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 year mandatory minimum, and in so doing, should enable the kinds of transparency and checks and balances that both Bill and I think are essential to a well-functioning federal criminal justice system. Now, again, and Bill and I have talked about this before, how this will play out in the 94 federal districts across the nation, how different U.S. attorneys' offices will end up applying this policy, is worthy of close examination, because the other thing that we know, well prior to Attorney General Holder's speech, prior to this administration, and in all of the federal criminal justice administrations of the last three decades, we've seen dramatic variation from jurisdiction to jurisdiction within the federal system in the way in which prosecutors charge and plea bargain mandatory minimums. And so at the same time that I think there's good reason to encourage a turn to Congress to turn some of these proposals into statutory law rather than just be exercises of prosecutorial discretion, that's not the only place I would start. I think Congress should have a much more robust role in investigating the work of federal prosecutors to see what kinds of patterns we're noticing on the ground, and not just sort of beat up the messenger, which I think is what's going on at times with Attorney General Holder for what's obviously his statements concerning broad policies, but also to be digging into whether federal prosecutors nationwide are in fact consistently exercising their broad constitutionally guaranteed but still worthy of scrutiny discretion in bringing certain charges and plea bargaining away certain charges in categories of crime that Congress has made a federal priority.
Gentlemen, we've got a caller here who's been waiting patiently for a while now. Why don't we go to this caller for their question?
Good afternoon. So sorry for interrupting the debate, but I was just wondering if the professors would change their opinion of whether he'll be acting within his authority if the RAINS Act is passed. Is this something completely outside the framework of RAINS? And if it is, would you be for something more like RAINS that clarifies when an attorney general has the power to do something like this? Thank you.
Who wants to respond to that? Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead, Bill. I'm not familiar with the RAINS Act, so
yeah, neither am I.
Well, the RAINS Act. I'll give you a quick thumbnail sketch. The RAINS Act essentially would require Congress to give an up or down vote to major regulatory action. So, a proposed regulation that would have an impact of greater than $100 million would not go into effect without Congress saying thumbs up to it.
But I think that would be an extra expenditure of $100 million, not a saving of $100 million.
It'd be an impact of $100 million. Yeah. I think what the caller's getting at here is maybe the best way to – I think the RAINS Act is probably not applicable here. But I think the question then becomes, should Congress tighten the prosecutorial discretion that's available to attorney general holder.
Right.
I think we heard from Professor Berman that maybe there should be more consistency across U.S. attorneys' offices, but as a legal matter in the first instance, should attorney general holder not be permitted to make a call like this, at least so in such a blanket sort of way?
I guess, as I've been saying, my view of it is that he should be permitted, and the Constitution does permit him to make the call, but for the reasons in my opening statement, I just don't think it's a very good call. The authority to do something and the wisdom of doing something are two very different questions. As to the RAINS Act, Dean, as you have described it, and again, I did not before right now know anything about it, but from the way you've had the chance very briefly to describe it, I tend to be in favor of it. I think that what is happening now is we're becoming a regulatory state where unelected federal regulators are able to impose enormous consequences on private citizens, but without the visibility or the political accountability that should be required for when the consequences are going to be that big. This goes into something that actually does play into criminal law, and where Doug and I think, are in agreement, although, of course, he'll have to say so well, and that is that it seems to me the growth of regulatory crimes where criminal liability is imposed without mens rea, that is, without bad intent, is very worrisome to me. And it's done principally in the area of the exploding administrative state. It seems to me that we ought to want to preserve the traditional link between criminal accountability and criminal intent. And to the extent that the regulatory administrative state breaks that link, I think it's troublesome, and it's something where we need to require, as apparently the RAINS Act would, at the minimum, greater accountability for the people in the government, for the regulators who want to impose these either criminal or quasi-criminal consequences.
Professor,
before you go on, let me just clarify that although we all seem to refer to it as the RAINS Act, it hasn't been signed into law. So at this point, I suppose
the RAINS proposal, right?
Yes, the RAINS bill.
Very good, and I can sort of throw in an extra criminal sentencing kicker here that's very valuable. Interestingly, when Congress set up the U.S. Sentencing Commission, the way in which it structured the rulemaking power of the U.S. Sentencing Commission, which is an interesting regulatory agency in the sense that it's stuck in the judicial branch and has judges a part of it, and that itself led to a constitutional debate early in the history of the U.S. Sentencing Commission. But one piece of that story is the commission actually produces a variety of proposals to change the sentencing guidelines, which used to be themselves mandatory, now are advisory because of another set of constitutional conversations. But any changes to the guidelines that the commission proposes are submitted to Congress, and Congress has a six-month period in which they can pass legislation to reject those changes. And in fact, quite famously, Congress did in the mid-90s, and it was signed by President Clinton when the commission first tried to adjust the ratio between crack sentencing and powder sentencing. And I very much like structurally the idea that any very significant change in criminal law, whether in its application through work by the Attorney General or through administration, through the Sentencing Commission or other federal agencies, gets in front of Congress. And then we get to some very interesting devils in the details. Should it be the case that it's good enough for Congress to express disapproval of that, or do we actually want to require a formal bill with the president's signature? That's the way it works out in terms of overruling commission proposals to amend the guidelines. And again, this is where I think we have more points of agreement than disagreement, that having all the branches play a role in criminal sentencing is something that not only I think actually has deep historical roots, but is very consistent with the framer structure. And then whether it's through something like the Raines proposal or other mechanisms, I certainly think giving Congress a variety of requirements to weigh in on what the Attorney General is proposing would be an awfully good idea. Of course, the reality is, as Bill and I have talked about, there are ways that Congress can and probably will end up turning to these issues, and whether that ends up leading to a direct or indirect ratification through statutes of what the Attorney General is proposing and is implementing through his discretionary authority, or whether we get pushback. And that pushback can take a variety of forms, both formal and informal. And I do think that kind of dialogue is essential. And I guess this is where this forum comes in too as well, that we get a refined understanding of what are the costs and benefit, both in economic terms and other terms, so that we can make good policy judgments when I think, despite historic disagreements on the left and right over crime policy, there often is considerably more synergy here in terms of both goals and means than there are in a variety of other public policy areas.
Well, gentlemen, I think we've exhausted the audience in terms of their questions. I do want to give each of you a chance to express any final thoughts. We've been back and forth and covered a lot of territory, and why don't we go in reverse order than when we started. So, Professor Berman, you want to take a minute or two just to wrap up before we adjourn?
Absolutely, and I'll wrap up with what is my favorite theme, both when I teach in the classroom and when I work on my research, which is sentencing is hard. And thanks for that, because it's not only giving me a career, but it means that I come at any of these sets of issues with a deep humility, both with respect to my own perspectives on what's the best policy to achieve the most benefits at the least cost to society, but also a humility about the way in which times can and do change in terms of what society's needs are, and the way in which we assess costs and benefits. You know, we can look at debates over issues ranging from the war on drugs to white-collar offending to any number of other kinds of crimes and punishments where we necessarily see not only a nimbleness in society's views, but a need to be refined in our response to new crime problems and new sets of societal concerns. And it's that very humility in my own perspective that this is always going to be hard that leads me towards embracing more refined and nuanced proposed solutions. And that's my perspective ultimately on what the Attorney General's speech reflects, is that mandatory minimums, generally speaking, are a relatively crude way to respond to a set of hard and complicated problems, and that a slight move away from crude tools, though they may be effective by some people's calculations, is always a move in the right direction.
Professor Bill Otis.
The main things that were troublesome to me about the Attorney General's speech were its forgetfulness and its complacency. he seemed to me to have forgotten where we've been in the 60s and 70s, although he's old enough to remember. Doug was mentioning earlier in our conversation that it would be better if we had a way of encouraging people who might be inclined toward crime to turn away from that and to live a better, more wholesome life, if we had a better way of doing that than imprisonment. In the 60s and 70s, that hope was very much alive, which is why there was so much emphasis on rehabilitation. We learned an unfortunate lesson. The lesson is that we don't know how to rehabilitate, and that the instruments of government are not only broad brush, they just don't work very well in changing people's behavior. So we are left with a second best, which is not very good at all, but it has been shown to work, and the second best is imprisonment. I would that it were otherwise, but history has shown that it's not. The other part of this is what struck me as the Attorney General's complacency. We have made a great deal of progress in the thing that people care most about when they evaluate the criminal justice system, and that thing is, how much crime is there? How much danger am I in when I walk the street at night? And in terms of that most important criterion, we're far better off now than we were 20 years ago or 40 years ago during the 60s and 70s. The Attorney General evinced just no recognition of that. He said, to the contrary, that our criminal justice system is, quote, ineffective, unquote. And it's just not true. I think the Attorney General would do better, and we, the citizens, would do better if we had less forgetfulness, less complacency, and more acknowledgement of the hard realities of what makes for a safer, more law-abiding country.
Very good. Thank you both. I want to thank, on behalf of the Federalist Society, both Professors Douglas Berman and Bill Otis for sharing their thoughts today. This has been an excellent discussion. To our audience, I encourage you to join us for our next Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, when once again we'll be discussing hot topics at the FCC with FCC Commissioner Ajit Pai. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.